Martinez will hear that.
May it please the court, my name is Andrew Hare. I represent Arthur Martinez. Mr. Martinez is appealing his convictions for second-degree assault and conspiracy to commit second-degree assault. I intend to address the first two claims raised in Mr. Martinez's briefs. I think structurally and conceptually the best way to proceed, at least for Mr. Martinez, is to address the second claim first, and within that context I'll address the first claim, which deals with the trial court's ruling on defense counsel's objection and the statements or comments that the court made in the context of making that ruling. And at the end of discussing argument two, I'll also make some perhaps some additional comments about the first claim made. Mr. Martinez contends that Casals, Hidrago, and Toler really control the outcome of this case. Those cases make abundantly clear, it's been Colorado law for quite some time now, that the standard jury instruction on self-defense is not adequate enough to apprise juries that a defendant who's not the initial aggressor does not need to retreat before he employs force in self-defense. The trial court here provided a jury instruction on the initial aggressor principle, but failed to instruct the jury on the no duty to retreat doctrine. In Casals is very persuasive in favor of Mr. Martinez. In Casals, the court was faced with the identical situation. The trial court refused to instruct on the no duty to retreat doctrine. As well, what's also interesting about Casals and very persuasive is the Supreme Court addressed, in as part of that claim, the prosecution's closing argument, which was very similar to, or almost nearly identical to, the argument in this particular case.
Well, just for starters, your client's counsel did not object, correct, at trial?
Correct. I have comments about whether the court should review it under the harmless error standard or plain error standard. In the context, your Honor's correct that at the outset or during jury instruction conference, defense counsel did not request instruction on the no duty to retreat doctrine. However, it was in the context of closing argument when the prosecution asserted basically that Mr. Martinez was not entitled to acquittal on grounds of self-defense because he could have left. They said he could have left, they could have left, and defense counsel objected that at that time, asserted that was a misstatement of the law, which it was, and asserted it was in conflict with the no duty to retreat doctrine.
Well, the reason I asked is, in Casals, wasn't that an objected to error? It wasn't a plain error standard?
Correct, it was. It was an instruction that was submitted, I believe it's in footnote 4 of the opinion, the
okay.
instruction that was submitted, that actually the defendant submitted an instruction that included both the initial aggressor principle and the no duty to retreat doctrine.
Thank you.
In Casals, the prosecution made, as I said, a very similar argument. They asserted that the defendant, Mr. Casals, made a conscious choice to go into his bedroom, retrieve a gun, come out and confront Mr. Morris, his roommate. They repeatedly said that he consciously chose to go into the bedroom, consciously chose to go out into the living area, and consciously chose, to engage in violence. Here we have a similar argument made by the prosecution, as I've just indicated. They asserted, not in the context of initial, Mr. Martinez being an initial aggressor, but strictly in terms of the context of whether or not he had the right to employ self-defense, talking about whether he was scared or not, whether he should have been in the car and driven around in the parking lot. And what they said was, he's not entitled to self-defense because he could have left, they could have left. And that's when the objection was lodged by defense counsel. Without this instruction, and Mr. Martinez's first assertion is that the court should have one, sustained the objection at the time defense counsel lodged it; two, ordered the parties to approach the bench and inform the parties that it was going to properly instruct the jury about the no duty to retreat instruction. But without such an instruction, and the court overruling the objection, the jury was free to infer that Mr. Martinez was not entitled to employ self-defense because he could have left. And that's pure and simple what happened here. It's a very straightforward claim. Cassell's, Hidrago, and Toler make it very clear about how this is very prejudicial to a defendant where the prosecution makes such a claim during closing argument and no such instruction is there to guide the jury properly in what no duty to retreat means. As far as the standard of review, again, I've indicated I believe that this is preserved by defense counsel's objection. It was precise. It was on point. He's actually absolutely correct about what the law is. The court, in response, injected really an erroneous reference to another principle, the initial aggressor principle. But first, just by overruling the objection, the court gave its imprimatur on this particular line of argument. That is to say, the jury, again, was free to go back and to deliberate and decide that Mr. Martinez was guilty of second-degree assault or any particular offense, the first-degree assault or second-degree assault for which he was ultimately convicted, because he could have left. He's not entitled to self-defense. Putting aside any issue of initial aggressor, which was also, of course, in play even by the trial court's own statements. If the court reviews it under the plain error standard of review, taking the Miller case, which is the latest basically on what the plain error standard of review is for purposes of jury instruction error, we have clearly this instruction, or excuse me, the jury instructions that were provided to the jury were not complete. They were incomplete. The jury instructions did not address the issue of no duty to retreat. So we have the first prong met. The second prong was whether or not the issue was contested at trial. Of course it was. This is a highly contested trial. I agree with opposing counsel that the facts are in conflict. We have two diametrically opposed stories. We have the jury trying to sift through to pick out what happened and didn't happen, what parts to believe and not believe. I understand we have this video, but if you've seen the video, as Detective Paul Bauer said, it's virtually, you can't really gather much out of that. Both parties tried to sort out what was happening, but it's not terribly helpful. So that second prong is met. Is there a reasonable possibility that the error contributed to his conviction? Of course there is. The prosecution's making the argument that he should be convicted because he's not entitled to assert self-defense, because he could have just left. And so for those reasons, whether it's under the harmless error standard or the plain error standard, Mr. Martinez's conviction should be reversed.
Mr. Harris, the statement he could have left, is that made in the context of before the altercation actually occurred, or is it made in the context of after the altercation commenced?
It was before, and I believe, reading the brief from opposing counsel, that they agree that that's in fact the case. But the closing argument was in reference to the co-defendant, Dominic Fernandez, driving his car allegedly out of the parking lot back into the parking lot, or at least at some point they're in the parking lot. And it was in that context when the prosecution asserts that, well, Mr. Martinez says he was so scared. What could he have done at that point? He could have left. They could have left. So, and then I think his opposing counsel also mentions in the opening brief, it's at that point, oh, the jury should be able to consider that he gets out of the car at that time. But yes, about when he was going to leave, it was before any physical altercation occurred.
Doesn't that mitigate against any prejudice here from not having an instruction on no duty to retreat? I mean, the argument seems to be could have avoided the altercation, and that doesn't implicate a no duty to retreat by itself, does it?
Absolutely. I believe it's nearly identical to the Cassell's scenario. When the prosecution is arguing that a defendant, where if he is in a place where he has a right to be, which Mr. Martinez was, if they're arguing that as a reason to infer that he cannot obtain acquittal on self-defense, that he needs to retreat, he needs to leave, he needs to go away, he needs to go to a place of safety, he's not allowed to drive through the parking lot. Yes, that does raise the issue of no duty to retreat. With regard to the first argument, dealing with the court's prejudicial comments, what we have is the court overruling the objection and then injecting into the case, really, a comment about a separate principle, the initial aggressor principle. And the court, basically, Mr. Martinez's position is, misconstrues the nature of the argument made by the prosecution and certainly the nature of the objection lodged by defense counsel, and again says that we have an instruction, that this argument is in line with the instructions, that we have an instruction on the initial aggressor issue. I find that there's some testimony in support of that Mr. Martinez was an initial aggressor. First, that's incorrect. That's not what the argument is about. And secondly, even if it were, it's exceedingly improper and highly prejudicial to comment on the evidence and to say in this particular context in a self-defense case that Mr. Martinez, that there's some evidence and testimony that he was the initial aggressor. The rules of criminal procedure, whether it's the criminal rules, the civil rules, the ABA standards, the Shuffle case dating back to 1943, all courts uniformly find that courts, A, should not comment about the evidence because juries, whether we like it or not, are going to hang on what a court says about a certain piece of evidence. And in this particular instance, it's critical to the case. It's about self-defense. It's about the gist of this case. And so that's why these particular comments are so prejudicial in this particular case. If the court has no further questions, I'd like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
May it please the court, John First for the people. The court was not required to sua sponte instruct the jury on no duty to retreat. And that's what we're talking about here. This particular issue is not preserved. The only objection below was to the prosecutor's factual statement, essentially. And indeed, in the context of this case, in the context of initial aggressor, it was what the prosecutor said was appropriate under that, and there was certainly evidence to support a finding by the jury that the defendant was the initial aggressor, particularly from the testimony of the victim and his friend. And in the context of initial aggressor, certainly there is a duty to retreat, and that's exactly the way the court interpreted the prosecutor's comment. I mean, we're talking in the court. I believe both parties have quoted the pertinent portion of the argument in the court's comments, so I don't. The court can refer to that. But first thing the court said upon the defendant's objection was that I think it's in line with the instruction on the affirmative defense. I mean, we're talking about jury instructions here. We're talking about how the jury is going to apply the law to these facts and what kind of reasonable conclusions the jury is going to make. And in that regard, they have to be fully instructed on all the applicable legal principles. And here there's nothing that raised a duty to retreat, raised the specter that the jury could have reasonably concluded that the defendant did at the time of the assault have a duty to retreat. Judge Casebolt, as you noted, this arose, the context of the prosecutor's comment was before the defendant got out of the car. At that point, not even self-defense was at issue. Could not have been. Defendant did testify that he saw the victim and his friend out in the parking lot, and he felt nervous because it allegedly he was told that he was a third-degree black belt, and he got inside the bar on the way out. The defendant and his and the co-defendant got this look from inside through the restroom door. They got the look, and that made him nervous. So nonetheless, that was evidence before the jury. However, at the point, and according to the defendant, when their defendant's driving out of the parking lot, the victim and his friend stepped in front of the car, and defendant told the co-defendant who was driving to stop so that he, the defendant, could mediate the situation. He didn't stop because he was afraid. He said, I've done this before. I've done this in prison. I can mediate this. At that point, there is no evidence that the defendant could have had a reasonable belief that he was going to be subject to the imminent use of unlawful force against him. He went to it. I mean, there's just no evidence of that. And in that respect, it's like Wilner, where our Supreme Court took a look at, even though there was evidence from defendant's testimony that he felt he was being pursued, the physical evidence showed that the vehicle was still in reverse, so that it just contradicted his testimony. Here, it's the same thing. There's just the physical evidence and the other evidence other than the defendant's testimony simply established that at that point he could not have asserted self-defense. And in terms of, as I started, there has to be this court has to reasonably somehow conclude that the jury would have determined that the defendant had this duty to retreat to a position of no escape before asserting self-defense. I mean, prosecution never argued that. Clearly the court didn't. Prosecutor related this opportunity they had to leave early on to the conspiracy. He said they could have left, but they didn't. They got out of the car pursuant to the agreement. Well, that's the so for the jury, prosecution tied it to the conspiracy count. And then on rebuttal, the prosecutor made one brief statement about it, tying it to the unreasonableness. And unreasonableness is what is the touchstone of self-defense here. So somehow the jury is going to have to figure for itself, conclude from this state of the evidence that at the time of the physical confrontation that the defendant had this duty to retreat. It's just not there. It's not there from the court. It's not there from the evidence. Certainly not there from the testimony of the prosecution witnesses. And at the point of the defendant said that he got out of the car, came in peace, and as he approached the victim, he said they made a gesture. And at that point, he responded by hitting the victim once. Now, reply brief states that, well, the jury must have obviously rejected the fact that the defendant had a deadly weapon. Well, it certainly isn't so obvious, because the jury necessarily found by convicting him of second degree assault that he caused serious bodily injury. Well, according to the defendant's testimony, he only hit him once, and that it was a co-defendant who was hitting away at him. Well, it was that hitting away that caused the horrible injuries that occurred here. So, I mean, they rejected that testimony of the defendant. I mean, who knows? I mean, it's just as likely that they rejected the intent to cause serious bodily injury, which would have been the mental state for the first degree assault. We just don't know, and we can't speculate on that. At most, it is one inference. Certainly, the jury's verdict doesn't preclude, and that defendant wielded this heavy flashlight.
And briefly, as to the trial court's comments about the evidence, this clearly is not like Schefter, where the court essentially took that issue of took an issue away from the jury, I believe, the issue of scrap metal. The court said it was not scrap metal. The court just simply said here, there's some evidence. Well, I mean, there has to be some evidence because for the jury instruction to be given to the jury. But beyond that, the court didn't stop there. It said it's for the court. I mean, it's for the facts for the jury to find. This court is not finding these facts. It's for the jury. And as to you will get an opportunity to counter, I mean, it's an isolated comment in the context of the whole trial where, I mean, and I cited numerous instances in my brief where the jury was instructed by counsel, by the parties, that it was the people's burden. And I like the court's comment. I believe it might have been during voir dire, but burden starts with the people, stays with the people, ends with the people. I mean, it's just for that one, for the jury to take that one comment and all of a sudden say, oh, defendant has the burden here. It just doesn't, it's not a reasonable interpretation of the record. Unless the court has any questions on any of these issues or any others, I just ask that you affirm these convictions. Thank you.
May it please the court. First, opposing counsel mentions that the arguments of the prosecutor were appropriate in the context and of the initial aggressor issue that had been raised, but then later says self-defense wasn't even on the table at the time that Mr. Fernandez was driving the car through the parking lot, which doesn't seem to make sense to me. The state has in their briefs wanted to have part of what the argument says to relate to self-defense and part of it later during some of this argument. No, they don't want it to relate because the problem they have is that the prosecutor below connected the duty to leave that they could have left directly with both offenses, not just one, as Mr. First contends. The last line before the prosecutor gets into this argument is self-defense, which is an affirmative defense to both of these, meaning both charges, which it was true, both as to conspiracy and to the lead charge of the assault. I don't think so. Ladies and gentlemen, right there it is. What could they have done? They could have left. Inextricably linked with the, in this particular argument, is that Mr. Martinez should not be permitted to avail himself of the right of self-defense because he could have left, pure and simple. He should have left. And when the cases that we have been reviewing, Hidrago, Toler, those cases, it's the same kind of argument. They're not going to say he has a duty to retreat. He should retreat. They're talking in colloquial phrases. He could have left. He should have driven off. And Casals, it was, he made a conscious decision. Even the trial court at sentencing in that particular case said he should have stayed in his bedroom and retreated to safety. It's those kinds of phrases that are used to tell the jury that the defendant should retreat. And if he doesn't, and he goes forward, he does not have the right of self-defense.
Counsel, isn't the difference here that in this case, your client was saying, Jim, I was so frightened of these people because he's a black belt, he brings a giant with him. And then as he drives off, he could have kept driving, but didn't. They come back. And then they come back, and the defendant gets out of the car and intentionally confronts the these two individuals. Doesn't that simply go to show, isn't that simply the prosecution attempting to defend against or to rebut a defense that GM is so terrified of these people?
I think it's designed to show that he's being aggressive. Unfortunately, it actually doesn't. Under Manzanares, the defendant cannot be shown to be an aggressor by somebody else's actions, somebody else's associations. He's not driving the car. Second, even if he were driving,
but he got out of the car. He didn't have to get out of the
correct.
Car to confront these people.
He doesn't have to get out, but if he does, he's allowed to get out of the car. And if we look at Casals again, Mr. Casals, he doesn't have to go out of his bedroom and go into the living room and talk to Mr. Morris with a gun in his hand, but he did. And that's, in that case, the court held, and everyone was, it was undisputed that he was not an initial aggressor and that that was not considered anything that would bar his defense. So, yes, and the reason the car was stopped, which was a good thing in view of what was happening, because these two individuals, Mr. Gonzalez, who's 6'3", 250, and Mr. Perez, who's a black belt in karate, got in front of the car. Now, they didn't use the car as a weapon. If that had happened, there might be a different, you know, view of whether or not Mr. Fernandez and Mr. Martinez were aggressors. He got out of the car. He's in a place where he has a right to be. He's allowed to get out of the car, and he's allowed to walk up to these individuals as well. And when this person makes a furtive gesture, which in particular the prosecution's hamstrung, and they can't really argue that Mr. Martinez flat out is the initial aggressor because Mr. Gonzalez is the one who testifies he threw the first punch. And so what we have is a very, I agree, it's a conflicting set of facts and circumstances. But the actions of Mr. Martinez are not that of an initial aggressor. And if the evidence raises it, as the court has said, the trial court said, let's say that it does, it's a fact question for the jury, and it's also a fact question whether or not Mr. Martinez had a duty to retreat at that particular point. And the jury should know that he has no duty to retreat unless the jury finds beyond a reasonable doubt he's the initial aggressor. I see my time has expired. I would ask the court to reverse both convictions and remand for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course. We'll take a 5-minute recess and return after that. The bailiff may announce the recess.